Well, welcome to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon session. Your panel for this afternoon is to my right, Justice Sue Walker, to my left, Lee Gabriel, and I'm Justice Ann Gardner. And we're happy to have you all with us. We only have two oral arguments scheduled for this afternoon, but we have several cases to be submitted that will be discussed in conference. The two cases beginning with in the estate of Robert Cole, deceased, versus Denton. Not sure how that is. I'll ask Bonnie to call the first case.
And
that was a typo. Are the lawyers ready? Okay. Proceed then.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I represent Judy Cole, who is the surviving wife of Robert Cole Sr. They were married approximately 13 years and he died leaving a will. That will had a number of issues in it. Many were litigated non-jury, on which a final judgment was issued and never appealed. But there was a jury trial following that in which a number of issues were submitted, and the jury answered some of the jury questions, but not others, because they were conditioned upon previous answers, and we think that issue will be important. We have assigned a number of issues on appeal. One is, was there in fact an election required under the facts and circumstances of this case and this will? The court ruled as a matter of law that it was an election will, and that matter was of course not submitted to the jury. We have attacked that on the basis that we think that's an incorrect ruling. That is a pivotal ruling to the outcome of this case, so that's why he addressed it first. The second one is, did the appellant make an election? Now that's interesting because the case law says that whether or not an election is required is a matter of law. Whether or not an election has been made is a matter of fact. That question was submitted to the jury, answered contrary to my client. Our position is there is no evidence to support that answer. Issues three and four, there were capital improvements, we say, that were made during the marriage for which reimbursement was sought under the formula in the family code, that we submitted a jury question to that, and the jury, for reasons that I guess we trial lawyers will never know, failed to find that any of the requested subparts of that jury question were capital improvements. We think an examination of those issues and the supporting facts show that that's the failure to answer that is against great weight and preponderance of the evidence, shows the prejudice of the jury. Issues five and six, there was an issue of good faith and just cause. As you all probably know, there was an amendment to the probate code fairly recently, section 64, which provides that if there is a finding of good faith and just cause, that can defeat a forfeiture clause in a will. The problem is that the jury answered not good faith and not just cause, but the difficulty was in the instruction. The standard pattern jury instruction was given, but then an addendum was tacked onto it, which was totally inconsistent with the previous instruction and was tantamount to an instructed verdict. We think that that has caused the answer to be wrong and will have to be disregarded and will precipitate a new trial.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Kelsey. If this court were to agree that the trial judge's determination as a matter of law that this was an election will is correct, and if this court were to determine that there was evidence to support the jury's verdict that your client did make an election, do we even reach any of your other issues?
I think you do, Your Honor. And I think the reason why is because there has to be proof, of course, that that's true. And I realize that's a couple of ifs that we're assuming that. We think that the good faith and just cause is an entirely different issue. And here's the problem that we have. Either she inherits under the will or she does not take under the will. If she takes under the will, then she gets what's under the will. Their position is, no, you don't. And the reason you don't get it is because you did not show that your contest, they're calling it a contest, it is not a contest, good faith and just cause. So they're trying to say, we win, tails you lose. And we think that's why the good faith issue is absolutely critical to the judgment in this case. I don't know that I've explained that.
I think I understand what you're saying, but I didn't get that from the briefing, from their briefing, that they're saying that she, the clause that you're talking about, that she forfeited any right to claim under the will because she didn't meet that statutory requirement. I didn't read their briefing that way.
No, they have not asked for that there, but unfortunately, if you'll take a look at the court's judgment, it's a very, very difficult judgment to apply to any of the rights of the parties. There is almost no decretal language contained in the judgment. There's a lot of affirmance of findings. I, the judge, find that the jury decided this. I, the judge, find that the jury decided that. Nowhere in this judgment is there anything about a forfeiture. There is no provision of this judgment that decrees a forfeiture.
So she gets what she gets under the will.
Well, we would like to think so. We wish that would be true. Unfortunately, and I realize it's not in the pleadings, but in the dialogue before the trial court, and in the post-judgment dialogue, which is not part of the record because it's not part of the facts, the basic position was you get absolutely nothing. That because of the lack of good faith and just cause, you get nothing under your claim for your inheritance under the will, and because of the answers to the jury, you get nothing for your provisions demanding your asking for your community property share. So that's the one of the positions here, is that looking at this judgment, we can't tell what the court decreed in regard to any of those provisions.
That really hasn't been raised as an issue on appeal for this court to decide, has it?
It has. Our last point of error covers that specifically, about that very problem. The last portion of our last six or seven pages of our brief covers that. And I believe it does. I mean, I can look and see. But I think it's in there, and it says that the good faith and just cause is important because it affects both concepts of forfeiture. An election will is probably not directly a forfeiture, but it results in the loss of a community property right. So call it what you will, it's a forfeiture. If she had property right and that property right no longer exists, then that's a forfeiture. Our problem with it is that, first of all, I hope the court understands we don't agree with the two ifs that the court has proposed, and I know that you do, that if we find that the will and that there was an election will, then we have to find what was the election. Was it to take under the will or to take against the will? Their argument is that by merely making a claim for the community property in the securities account, which the jury found in our favor, and asking for reimbursement under the family code, which the jury found against our position, that merely by making those claims, that they are claiming that we forfeited both rights. We get nothing. We don't get what we wanted under the will, what we got under the will, and we don't get any of the community property rights as well.
Well, really, under the will, what she got was to live in the house for the remainder of her life and the personal property that was in the house.
Uh, Correct, Your Honor, except the first one was not really a bequest under the will. It was under recognition of the statutory right.
Recognition, okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to nitpick on it, but it was not a gift in the will.
But that's what she got under the will.
Got
much.
The tangible personal property located on the 23 acres. That's correct. That's what she got.
That's it, is it not?
That's it. And that.
You're saying they're denying her that?
I think if we go back to court on this judgment the way it's written, that's exactly the position they're going to take. Unless they, in open court now, disavow that, which I'd be very pleased if they would, but we'll see whether they do. And that's been our concern all along, is their position is a heads we win and tails you lose, which I don't think they can do that. I don't think they can take both sides of that argument. But their concept is, under the election clause, you lose the personal property. Under the forfeiture clause, you lose any other your bequest under the will. So that we get, my client gets nothing under that concept. So I think, and that's a problem that we think needs to be faced. And in all candor, part of that's as a result of the final judgment. If a reading of that final judgment, as I pointed out in the brief, does not really decree anything except for hunting equipment and attorney's fees. That's the only rendition of a judgment that's contained in there. So we will ask you, that is briefed, latter part of our brief. We did have one issue, which is issue number 7 we're just talking about. Is a remand for retrial necessary? What if you decide to remand the case, what is the correct level of the remand? Does the whole case go back? Can we cherry pick issues that the jury decided and not send those back? And that has also been briefed. But I won't spend a lot of time on that. If I would, I'd like to move to the first question, which is whether or not this will requires a an election. It's a strange law that the Dakin case, followed by the Worth case out of this court, and the Leach and the Dunn cases, all, this is on page 7 of the brief, that quoting from Dakin, which is Supreme Court, first, the party must have had knowledge of his rights. That is, he must have had knowledge of the condition and extent of the estate. Now, we objected to the idea of being forced to an election before we knew whether we had a community property right or not. How can we know what we're electing? How can we know what our bargain is if we don't get an answer first to do we have a right of reimbursement and how much is it? And do we have a right to participate a community property interest in account number 015? How can we be put to an election in satisfaction of the Dakin requirements when we don't have any idea the factors that are in play in making that election? It's impossible to know, because whether we get a community property reimbursement and the amount of that reimbursement is a jury question.
Well, but if that were the case, then you would be entitled to litigate that every time before you'd be required to make an election, which also doesn't make any sense.
Well, it does in this case, Your Honor. I agree with you in general that you would be correct, because in most cases, there's no dispute about whether it's community or separate property interest. If you read all those cases, and there are a ton of them, the community property element is acknowledged in every one of those cases. It's not an issue of, is there a community property question? But how can you trade something when you don't know what the elements of the trade are? Suppose the jury had said, nope, no reimbursement. Suppose the jury had said, nope, no community property interest in the securities account. Well, we will have lost that. And now we can say, yes, we will definitely take under the will because we know what the trade is. But suppose that they had answered as they did, in the securities account, that we have a substantial community property interest in that securities account on valuation somewhere around $70,000, $80,000. So the jury validated our position on that. Now, they did not validate the position on the reimbursement, but if you look at the elements of the reimbursement in the jury charge, and that appears on page 7 of the jury charge, there is no question that at least some of these things are capital improvements. Fencing, clearing, horse barn, roads, pole barn, water well, pump. I won't repeat all of them, but under the definition given in the jury charge, there is no way the jury could not have found those to have been capital improvements. There were two experts that testified. They both testified there were capital improvements. They both testified that she had a community property interest in those improvements. Jury found they weren't even community property improvements. Now, that by conditional submission cut us off from the value of that which you could use to calculate a judgment on. So it has to come back on that question unless the court decides, as you mentioned earlier, that the answer doesn't matter. That would be the only way to avoid that particular problem. Now, the second thing it says that you have to know that you have a duty to choose. Now we get to the will. Nowhere in this will does it say to the widow, you've got to take this or you've got to take that. It is my intention to put you to an election. What is interesting is that the will itself, in stating the intention of the parties, at the very first sentence of the will, on top of page two, it is my intention, and we have a direct declaration of intention, in this will to dispose of all my property, real, personal, and mixed, including my one half in the community property of myself and my wife. Now that is the Miller case. And that's almost verbatim out of the Miller case where they said, well, that, then everything else following that is predicated upon that statement. It is my intention not to dispose of my community property interest of my wife. Now that, if you take the other, oh, I'm sorry, I've run out of time. I'll quit for now, but I'll be back.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kelsey.
Thank you.
Now we'll hear from the appellees. Mr. Monning.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
As you know from my brief, I did not participate in the trial of this case. It was, however, 6 years ago, almost to the day, when I was called to Denton County by a judge that told me he was dying of cancer and didn't have a will. I wrote this will. And I'm a little embarrassed that it's taken 6 years to litigate over what I thought was the simplest possible will. But I hope the court ends up agreeing with me that it's simple and it's easy to understand. And I was presented with a circumstance in which a judge had his second marriage, had children from a former marriage, and had a widow that he wanted to leave the home and everything in it too. He also had an account that he considered his separate account. He wanted to leave that to his son. He did not present me, however, with a prenuptial agreement. He did not present me with a postnuptial agreement. How do I accomplish that for him? And I accomplished it by including in the interorum clause a phrase. And the phrase says, if anyone contests my will, including the characterization in this will of my separate property, that person's disinherited. Honestly, even to this day, I can think of no better way to place an election provision in a will than to tell the beneficiaries, don't argue about whether it is my separate property. If you do, you're disinherited. That's what it said. And that's what she did. Three times in this will, Judge Cole enumerated this 015 account as my separate property, and he mentioned it a fourth time when he said, if anyone contests any provision of this will, including characterization of my property as my separate property, they'll take nothing under the will. You know, I think that imposes an election. I think the judge in the probate court got it right. But the issues, though, in this case, and there's this, you know, I learned something when I got their reply brief on Friday that I didn't know. I briefed this case based upon the record that was before the Court of Appeals, based upon the record that was in the Court of Appeals when the appellant filed their brief, when the appellant filed their amended brief, and when we came down here and got the record on appeal. And there was no 34.6C notice in that record. I therefore file, responded, as I think I'm entitled to in our brief, by explaining to the court that all you have is a partial record on appeal. When you've got a partial record on appeal, no evidence and insufficient evidence points go away. That standard is almost too old to cite cases. I think I cited some anyway. I learned on Friday that they claim that there is a 34.6C notice. And in their amended brief, they tell you that that notice is in your file, and it was placed in the record on July 11th of this year in the supplemental clerk's record. Well, I went and looked at that supplemental clerk's record, and that supplemental clerk's record that they tell you in their brief included their 34.6C notice does not include the 34.6C notice. It includes, what is it? It is an application from the appellant in this case for a widow's allowance. Now, the courts are liberal on this application of 34.6C. You can be late. It's okay. We're going to let you be late when you limit the issues and request a partial reporter's record. And you can be really late. You can even be, under one case, 2 months late. And the court will let them get away with it. But this court, the only time this court has dealt with it is in the CMM Grain Company against a name I can't pronounce case. It's not in our brief because I didn't learn this till Friday. It's at 991 Southwest 2nd 437. This court held that an appellant must timely and properly file that 34.6C notice in order to get the benefit of filing a partial record, and proof of that compliance by the appellant must be in the appellate record. Your Honors, this appellate record still to this day does not include a 34.6C notice except for Appendix B to the reply brief that was filed last Friday. Now, the law tells us, and the Supreme Court told us in the Bennett against Cochran case, that it's okay if they're late. We want to be fair on appeal, and they let somebody file a 34.6C notice 2 months late. But the Supreme Court in that case said at the time that notice was filed, the appellee still had 2 months before the appellee's brief was filed. This case is dramatically different. Without the benefit of my prior counsel's record, but with the benefit of the record on appeal, I submitted a brief to this court, and that brief was based upon the record that was on file with the court, and that record included no limitation under 34.6. It's done. It's already, the brief's been filed. Now, I struggle, should I be requesting an opportunity to cross-designate since I just learned that they had limited the appeal? I don't think so. I think the rule is you comply with your opinion. In the CMM Grain Company case, it's too late for them now to supplement the clerk's record and rely upon this notice. It's particularly so in this case when my client's predecessor, his sister, she died. Her lawyer did not continue with the case. I had to step back into this case and try to brief the case based upon the record that was before me, the same way this court has to decide it based upon that record. Judge Gabriel, you asked a question of Mr. Kelsey. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. What I do know is that the judgment that the judge signed did deny all relief that Mrs. Cole requested. Now, it doesn't mention the dishes and the dishwasher and the horses and the cows and the vehicles that she got under the will, but it did specifically mention, I think, the dog trailers and some guns, okay? But I do believe that if this court finds that this will called for an election and she in fact made an election, this case is over. There's nothing else to argue about under the judgment that has been appealed. Now, I wanted to go back, and I forgot to say something. If this court disagrees with me that it's okay, they can late file This court did write a letter to them in January and told them that they need, if they're going to do a designation of record, they have to file it with this court. They didn't do it. Still haven't done it. But assuming that they get away with late filing the 34.6C notice, and that we have to presume that all of the testimony that's there that they brought forward is the testimony on these issues that they're raising legal and factual sufficiency points of, you still have to affirm. Because all of the testimony that you have is the testimony of interested witnesses. And the testimony of an interested witness under 100 years of Texas law, the testimony of an interested witness does no more than create an issue of fact. Your honors will recall times when you've been trying cases, sometimes the other side's witness gets up there and says something, and the rule number one of cross-examination is don't. Because the jury's entitled to disbelieve anything an interested witness says. When a witness says the light is green, that is evidence that the light was red. That is the law when it applies to interested witnesses. Now, there is an exception to that rule. And it applies usually, where it most often applies, is when the jurors award $0 for attorney's fees. There's plenty of case law out there that says, even though that lawyer that testified to attorney's fees was interested, that lawyer's testimony was clear and it was uncontradicted, that fact is established as a matter of law. This isn't that case. We've got the testimony of a widow, an interested witness, that the jury was just entitled to disbelieve everything she said. Now,
What about the other testimony?
There was testimony.
Not interested witnesses.
Yeah, there was testimony of a Maya Jean Alexander. She was a real estate broker. She testified concerning the value of the home. Well, that issue wasn't even answered by the jury, okay? And then there was some testimony from another fellow. I think I called him two different things in my brief. His first name was Chip. It was Chip Sargent was his name. I called him Chip Shackelford. His testimony was, they claimed that his testimony was that repairs to the fence and repairs to the roof, repairs to the air conditioner, and poisoning the pond, that those were improvements. The jury found that they weren't. They found that they were repairs. That's it. Those are the only three witnesses that are in the record. Just real quickly on Dakin against Dakin. That's the case, that the seminal case on the widow's election. And I suppose it's now sexist today to refer to it as the widow's election, but that's what the doctrine's been called. In Texas jurisprudence, this will again gave her a choice. The beneficiary under will does not have to take under a will. They can take whatever their rights are, but she took under the will, and she took, you know, not just this constitutional right that she clearly had to remain in the property. She took everything that was in the house, everything that was in the barns, all of the animals, all of the cars, taxes. Payment of taxes on her property was called for under the will, and payment of all expenses related to the probate. About $220,000 was paid for under the provisions of that will. She accepted all that. That's just fine. Now, Dakin tells us on its face, it doesn't even have to be reasonably equivalent value. If you take something under the will, you're stopped. Now, this one other thing that Dakin points out. She has asserted a claim for reimbursement for what she believes were community property improvements to the house. Dakin against Dakin speaks to that very issue. In Dakin, the question was, is there a right to reimbursement for separate or community funds that went into the improvement of the homestead? The Supreme Court in Dakin said, yes, you do have a right, just as in a divorce, to seek community property improvement. But when the beneficiary is living in the homestead, the Supreme Court said that it is no equity to prevent surviving spouses to impress certain property brought and improved principally by community funds as a homestead to be used during her lifetime to demand at the same time repayment. Dakin takes care of that. The claim is that Mrs. Cole is making that She gets to stay in this homestead. She gets to keep everything in it. But that because some improvements were made to the property, she gets reimbursed. Dakin throws that out. You can't do that. And you can't do it because the Supreme Court said it just doesn't make sense.
Let me ask you this. If I'm going to give you the same ifs I gave Mr. Kelsey. If this court were to agree that this was an election will and agree that there's sufficient evidence that she elected under the will, given the final judgment in this case, and that, let's just say we affirm without reaching the other issues, is it your position that you go back to the trial court and try to regain the personal property awarded under the will?
Judge, I don't. I do not claim that, and I can represent to you, I won't. Now, I won't because I have talked way back there when Judge Duckcole died. I talked with his widow, and I probably gave her some legal advice. There's been an agreement that I may defend this judgment. That's all I can do. I'm not going to do anything further. But I can tell you that I'm not aware of any claim that's been asserted to anything else. I think that all relief that was requested by either party, other than what was in that judgment, was denied. That's just what the law is. And I know that all claims that Karen Cole, executrix, asserted in her pleadings, to the extent they weren't granted, they were denied. All claims that Judith Cole asserted, to the extent that they weren't granted, they were denied. And I think that's the end of the inquiry. Now, we do intend to enforce the monetary award that we got in the judgment, but not to go start picking up plates and silverware, and the cars have been sold. So I don't think so, Judge Gabriel. I'll yield the remainder of my minute. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Money. We have rebuttal from counsel for appellant.
You can see that's the same answer we've gotten to the same question for months and months and months, Judge Gabriel, is that they will not state categorically that you can keep what the will gives you. There was an election, you can keep what the will gave you, but you have to give up your interest in everything else. And it wasn't answered this time either. And that's exactly the reason why we're here on that issue. Now, I cannot ask you enough to please read the Wright case that's cited in the opinion. What it amounts to is it says, quote, if the will is open to a different construction, that is, if it's ambiguous, if you've got it's my intent, to mine is mine, and that's exactly what it says in the case, that then there's a possibility of requiring an election over here. This is not a factual determination. This is not a resolution of an ambiguity. Because what Wright versus Wright says is, unless it is conclusively established, there is no fact judgment, even for the trial court. And what it says is, even if it's ambiguous on this point, as a matter of law, the beneficiary is not required to elect, since, as a matter of law, his or her property is not disposed of by will. This is the rule of all decisions here and above cited. Now, this case is the one that Judge St. John Garwood wrote about in his dissent. And he said, if you take the other position, then every single gift to every single widow in every single will is subject to the fact of you shouldn't have gotten that much, or you shouldn't have taken this. This means this forecloses the widow to her community funds and bank accounts. It exposes the widow to all of that. It's briefed in the brief. I know I don't have time to go back over it, but those quotes are directly out of Wright versus Wright. It is not a factual presumption. It is a legal presumption. And if there is any inconsistent provision in the will between the language of my and our, as stated in Wright, but then there's another thing that would look like it causes a gift to be given, which is the forfeiture clause in this case, then there's no election required. It's expressly stated as it could be. And that was affirmed again by this court in Worth versus Scherer, which is cited in the case. Now,
what is your response to his argument that you've never filed your 30?
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. We actually, what happened was we made the 34.6C1 designation after the original designation. That is, it wasn't required until that time. We made it. We thought it was already in the record. When we found out it was not in the record, because it was actually filed and it's attached, on January the 23rd, 2014, that's almost a year ago, it was filed and properly, timely filed. Now, they were given copy of it, and it shows on a certificate of compliance, of communication. They were told. We also have communication from this court, which is attached, which says a supplemental clerk's record has been filed. We thought that was part of the supplemental clerk's record. It was not itemized in the letter, which is attached as Exhibit B to our reply brief. What that was, we thought that was what they had filed. We requested a timely supplemental request, and we thought that this complied with it. I have not looked at this record. This is news to me that it was not part of what we requested to be included. So we would ask for leave of court. It's very substantive to this case. Is substantive to the justice of this case. They did have notice that it was filed, and it's only fair that in the consideration of the points, we'd be given an opportunity. If counsel had asked for an opportunity to supplement his brief, I would have been happy to agree to that. And the other thing that bothers me is there were a number of comments made by counsel outside the record. We would ask that the court properly not consider those. It is our position that the Wright case controls this case, because the me, my, our in the beginning of the will is exactly verbatim what the court ruled on in Wright, created an ambiguity with a subsequent possible election issue, but it's a legal presumption. You have to conclusively establish that the legal presumption of my, ours is not applicable in this case. And the will itself says apply Texas law. And that's what we're trying to do, is apply Texas law. So I will ask the court to take a look at Wright. We think that Wright is the controlling precedent in this case. Could it possibly have put an election? Possibly, yes. There's an argument. But that doesn't satisfy the requirements of Wright. Wright has never been overruled. It's never been disapproved by the Supreme Court. It's been followed by this court in the Scherr case. So I don't understand why it would need to be changed at this point. We respectfully submit that the case should be reversed and remanded in its entirety, and we thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Well, that concludes the arguments in this case. Your case is submitted, and we appreciate your arguments and your briefs. Were you requesting from the bench a ruling as to whether you can have additional time to file the, I'm looking to see what the name of it is. It's in the original designation, Exhibit A.
It's Exhibit A to the reply brief, Your Honor, but it's designation for preparation of the order's record and specifically refers to the Code Rule 34.16.1. Obviously, it's intended to comply with that. If the court's prepared to rule on it now, we'll certainly accept the rule. If the court wants to think about it or send us a letter, really, that's fine too. Whatever, please.
You want to talk about it?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. We'll discuss it and let you know.
That's exactly right.
We'll be okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, and you're free to go.
Thank you.